sit at my table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Fantasy.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, in which we're hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week I'm again joined by my co-host Helena Seiferling. Our special guests this week are Aurora Ellig and Patience Umerowenza. Umerowenza, I got it,
yeah.
I think, who are members of the organization WUSC, I guess, WSC, the World University Services of Canada at the University of Regina. One of the things that WUSC does is run a student refugee program where they provide the funds for refugee students from around the world to come study at the University of Regina. Aurora and Patience will be talking to us today about this program, about the new refugee students that just arrived in Regina last night, and about refugee rights in general. Welcome, Aurora and Patience.
Good
to have
you. Thank you. Hi. All right. So, yeah, so we're going to talk about some exciting things today. So maybe to start with, do one or both of you want to tell us a bit more about what WUSC does and what it is and what you do at the University of Regina?
Okay, so WUSC is a student-run organization at the U of R. There's actually a local committee or a campus chapter at most universities across the country. So what WUSC does is that it facilitates the student refugee program, which sponsors student refugees from around the world to come live in Canada, and then they obtain their permanent residency, and our local committee acts as a social and emotional network, and we help them acclimate to Canadian lifestyle and student lifestyle and just integrate into society. The program is funded actually by a student levy that all University of Regina students pay. They pay $3 every fall and winter semester, which helps us sponsor the students when they come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that fee just went up this past year, right, which is exciting that
yep.
you guys received more money to be able to run your programming still. Yeah. So I think the student refugee program is not the only thing that you do, right? There's more things that WUSC kind of works on?
We run different campaigns during the year, and all these campaigns are supposed to support different issues that happen around the world. One of the campaigns that we're running this year is called Shine a Light Campaign. We've been working on it last year as well as this year. And Shine a Light Campaign is a campaign that actually works in a in the refugee camps, and it is a campaign that is supposed to help girls in refugee camps be able to catch up with boys in terms of schooling, and also be able to have more girls eligible for sponsorship to come to Canada. What happens in camps is that even though everyone has access to education, the girls sometimes tend to not be able to catch up with boys because of cultural expectation that are put on girls to be at home and do the housework. And so girls are not able to finish their homeworks on time, and they're not able to catch up with boys in the end, which means that we have more boys that get sponsored than girls. And at the University of Regina, I was the last girl that was sponsored since 2008, and so we've had 6 boys that come until this year, which we've finally had our first 4 girls in a very long time. So Shine a Light helps the girls by the first phase of Shine a Light was we bought lamps for the girls to study at night.
Solar lanterns.
Yes, solar lanterns for the girls to study at night, and we were able to do that. And the second phase is we were fundraising for
scholarships
so that the girls can have after-school programs to be able to study, do their homework after school if they weren't able to catch up with the boys. And the end, we're just trying to work up more scholarships to specifically help the girls catch up with the boys, and that everyone has equal opportunity to education.
Typically, for every 4 men that are sponsored by WUSC, only 1 girl is sponsored. So the main goal of the Shine a Light campaign is to make it so that that number will be equal within the next few years. The goal is that for every boy we sponsor, we also sponsor a girl. So
yeah,
that's what we've mainly been working on the past year, and we're continuing to work on this year. There are other campaigns that WUSC runs. There's Farm Radio, which is a program that connects farmers from around Africa that through
farmers in Canada, they share best tips practices. And so, and these tips are very simple tips. Sometimes it doesn't have to be elaborate tips. It could just be things such as putting cassette tapes on the, tying them on the wheat or the corn stalks, and then this will distract the birds away from the plants. And these are different tips that farmers in Canada are sharing to farmers in Africa, and it's done in a very sustainable and ecological way, which is just through radio. And so people are able to have access to this information, and it's creating a solidarity between farmers across the world.
Those are exciting. I actually didn't know about that last program, so now I learned something new.
That's really good for Saskatchewan.
Yeah, that seems like a great way we can get involved here in Saskatchewan. Anyway, so I think the main thing, well, probably the most exciting thing, I assume, right now, is the student refugee program for you guys, considering that yesterday you received 4 new students that Patience kind of talked about. So do you want to talk a little bit about what that program is and how it works, and then tell us about your exciting new arrivals?
Sure. So this year there are changes being made in terms of immigration. So as a result, this year our local committee was asked if we could take on more students than normal. Typically in the past, we have sponsored 2 students every year. This year we decided we had the finances to do it, and we have an incredibly strong committee, so we actually have the manpower to handle it as well. So we doubled our number, and we sponsored 4 students this year. And because of all the hard work that we did last year with the Shine a Light campaign, we requested that we get girls. So for the first time since Patience was sponsored, we got 4 girls. They're all Burmese that came from Thailand, from camps in Thailand. So they just arrived last night.
Yeah. It's really exciting because we haven't sponsoring Karen refugees. This is an ethnic group in Burma that have been victimized. Has been very difficult in the past because of different rules that Thailand has put on the refugee camps in Thailand, which has made it difficult for the girls to access things such as writing the TOEFL exams or getting their medical tests done, which would aid them to coming to Canada. And so, in fact, when I came to Canada, I was in Thailand but the program was closed for about 2 years because it was just very difficult to make the to process everything for the girls for just refugees in Thailand to come. And so we're very excited because now we're accepting refugees from Thailand, which means that we're opening more opportunities for refugees from different parts of the world to be sponsored, and it's creating a diversity in what we understand are refugees and where refugees come from. And you know, it's just opening more opportunities because when you sponsor one person, you basically help their entire family, because you educate one person, you educate the entire family, you stop the process of poverty, and it really helps the next generation to come.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, any idea what is motivating the Thai government to put these impediments in place?
You know, there's always been, delicately said, there's always been hostilities that mm-hmm. have run between Karen refugees and Thai officials. Mm-hmm. And also, Karen refugees, refugees in general in Thailand are not legal people. Mm-hmm. The Thai government never signed the UN Convention that I think was in 1952 or 54 that mm-hmm. made, that means that you would protect refugees if they were in your area.
Oh, okay.
Which means even when I was in Thailand, I was illegal. And so mm-hmm. refugees are not protected people. And on top of that, if there's ever been any kind of, you know, any kind of hostility that has mm-hmm. been going on, it makes it even more difficult for people to be more accepting right. of that particular group of people. And there's already been this long history between Thai people and the Karen people. And there's so many of them that if Thailand decided to sign the convention, for example, I mm-hmm. think there would be an overflow. I don't know. Right. They have maybe this fear that there'll be so many of them that would just overtake. And so it's trying to find the balance of mm-hmm. where, you know, we are able to, you know, tell the Thai people that it's okay, and also where Karen people gets their needs are met and mm-hmm. the international community is able to help at their fullest.
I see. Yeah. Okay. So mm-hmm. it's just their,
it's tricky.
Yeah, yeah. Their outlook on yeah. on refugees in general.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's very different. Yeah.
Mm. Wow. So I have a question as well about what the process is for how the refugees get here. You mentioned that there's a test they have to take, patients.
Yeah.
So is that then, I mean, if you requested girls this year, mm-hmm. Did these four do the best on the exam, or was there other, is there other considerations, I guess, that they, to, for them to determine who gets to come each year?
Well, this year was a special case because of the changes that are being made in terms of citizenship and Immigration Canada. They... WUSC had to sponsor more students this year than it ever has in the past, and not just our group, but WUSC National from mm-hmm. Ottawa. They, because of the changes, so there were by far more students sponsored that it was, if they didn't get in this year, they weren't going to get in again, because now there's quotas mm-hmm. being placed on the amount of refugees that can apply for this scholarship program.
Oh, wow.
So they are, so as a result, more students were taken this year because of those changes, so more yeah. schools across Canada accepted.
Yeah, but in general, the process in camps, I think generally the process is that all the students that come have to finish grade 12 to be able to enter Canadian universities, and so they finish their year, and yes, it is based on academic standing because there's mm-hmm. so many refugees that would love to come, and so it's, you know, you have to pick, I guess, the mm-hmm. best, I don't know.
The brightest
yeah,
minds.
Yeah, and also students that are able to adapt because they're coming to a new environment, they're not going to be with their families, and, you know, and this is, it's just students helping students, so, you know, you have to look into all these different factors that would help them adapt best, and in WUSC Ottawa makes it a point to go, for example, in the camps in Kenya and the camps in Malawi, like an official would actually go there, meet the students, talk to the students, and it's a process that can take, some students say it can take up to 2 years, where they interview you and they keep picking until they find the last person that they want. Then you go through your TOEFL to make sure that your English, when you do come, you are able to study, mm-hmm. Even if it's ESL, but at least you can speak English and write and read and all that stuff. And then there's the medical part, which is just a requirement that CIC, the Canadian Embassy, makes of everyone. And then after that, that's when, and then all this information is then sent to the Canadian Embassy. And then once you go through that process, which is really almost out of the hands of WUSC, and then that's when the students are able to come. So it's a combination of partnership between WUSC and the Canadian government.
So what do you think the government's trying to achieve here? It just seems a little strange to me that they would sort of slow you down, put these roadblocks in front of you.
it's not really, I don't believe it's the Canadian government that's, I think it's more UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees.
Mm-hmm.
It's, they get so many applications for sponsorship for refugees that as a result, it takes so many years to go through the amount of applicants that they, applications that they receive. Mm-hmm. So they have to limit the number of quotas that go from certain countries. So Kenya, for example, because mm-hmm. there's the world's largest refugee camp is in Kenya,
right.
they get more applications than other countries. So the Kenyan government has had to put a limit on the number of applications that they receive in a year, which has affected how WUSC works in terms of how many applicants it can receive. So I think it's just a way to try to limit it so that it doesn't mm-hmm. take so long, as opposed to hiring more people to handle the workload. They're trying to limit the workload so that it doesn't take 2 to 5 years for somebody to get sponsored. It can be done in a quicker, more expedited fashion.
So probably in the long run, the number is not going to be that much different. It's just, it'll take a shorter length of time to process.
Yeah.
So in the course of, say, 5 years, you'd have roughly the same number of people involved in the program? Do you think that would be?
Yeah, hopefully. But I mean, also we have to remember that there have been cuts made within mm-hmm. Canada on different, basically organizations such as CEDA and all these things that mm-hmm. do sponsor, that right. helps WUSC operate. And right. so, I mean, even though we can still maintain the number, I think we also have to remember that our funding in the country also affects how many students we can bring. Mm-hmm. So we're just hoping that the funding within the country, because for example, at the student level, we have no problem paying that $3 right. to bring the students, but
right.
on the government or the national, you know, I don't know, you know, there's problems on maintaining that funding mm-hmm. and that funding affects greatly how many students we can bring. And so even if there are people that are willing, that are able to come, if we don't have the money for it,
mm-hmm. you know. Right. Because our student levy will always make it so that we can continue to sponsor students,
mm-hmm.
but because of the cuts at the government level, meaning making it so that the national office cannot function at the way, at the level that it's used to, it cannot send its people over to the camps to interview the students, it can't have as many people working at this mm-hmm. as there used to be. So because of the cuts, it's the national level that's being affected as opposed to the local committees. We will mm-hmm. always have the money to sponsor students. It's mm-hmm. whether or not our national office has the money to find the students to then bring over here is the problem. So, and the problem that WUSC is finding now is that they're having a hard time maintaining the finances that they have or that they require to continue to keep the program running.
In Canada, you mean? Like at the national
yeah.
office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The national office doesn't have, it doesn't receive the same amount of funds as it used to, mm-hmm. so.
Mm. Yeah. Which is really sad because what WUSC does, I mean, it's a very unique program in terms that not only does it bring in a refugee to Canada, but it also gives them the tools to integrate right away, because by educating someone, it's different than just giving someone money and then, you know, the money will run out. But when you educate someone, you're basically giving them the tools to survive and they become, and all of our WUSC students are successful and they've, you know, they're valuable members of society. They're doing great work. And so you're giving them tools to survive and also tools to help them help their families. And so this program, and this is a program that cultivates leadership between members in Canada, because students in Canada are taking charge of these programs and saying, we want to help other people, other students. And so it's sad if these cuts affect how many students we can bring in, because, mm-hmm. you know, we're really going to be losing great people.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And to add on to that, our students as well, they come, WUSC is the only organization that has a contract with the government
mm-hmm.
that when our students come here, they are given permanent residency the minute they step onto Canadian soil off the plane.
That's
they don't
huge.
Come here.
Yeah.
That
is huge,
yeah. They That's don't come wonderful. Here as refugees.
Yeah.
They come here as landed immigrants mm-hmm. with permanent residence status.
Wow.
So they don't face the fear of having to go back mm-hmm. home. So they obtain all the same rights that a Canadian citizen would have, minus the ability to vote, which they would receive after they become a citizen after living here for so many years. So, and it's the only organization that has that agreement with the government that gives our students that. So we're giving them more opportunity
mm-hmm.
and they have the ability to work as soon as they get here, although we encourage them not to work because education is their main goal.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I was going to say, if you were listening to the radio show a few weeks ago, we had a guest on here who he was originally from South Sudan, and then he was in a refugee camp in Kenya, I believe, might have been the largest one you spoke about, and then he came to Canada through WUSC, and now he has his education degree, and he's going back and forth doing lots of work back in South Sudan and in Canada, and working to educate both people here in Canada and people back home. So that was really, really cool. So as you mentioned, that he's just like this great, thriving member of our society, like really contributing to our culture here in Canada, here in Regina, as well as helping back in South Sudan. So it's just, I guess, an example of the great people that come through the program. So yeah, it's definitely a really good program. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And I was going to say something else as well.
Our students consistently make the dean's list as well.
Oh.
We have one of our current students is an honors student. We can boast that our previous sponsored students work for different federal ministries. One works for the Saskatchewan Ministry of Health. So they're active contributing members of society that are doing wonderful things for here and their homes.
And something else, so you guys are all volunteers, right?
Yes. Yeah. None of this is a paid position whatsoever. Countless hours go into making this committee function the way it does.
Yeah, I think that's another important part of it. Like, I'm assuming at the national office there's people that work, right? And that's their job. But at each university, as far as I understand, it's just students that are volunteering, right?
Yes.
That decide that this is an important thing and they're going to work on it at their university. And so everything that I've heard so far in terms of like preparing before the students get here, helping them out when they have questions around campus, or helping them get to class, helping them learn the way around Regina, all of these things are all the volunteer work that you guys do, I think, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's it's a student-led initiative, so if we were to be paid, then it changes that dynamic. So making us volunteers, it just puts us on the same level as our sponsored students, so then there isn't a hierarchy when they come here, so we give up hours at work so that we can have office hours at the university so that they can come meet with us at any time, and so there's a lot that goes into it, and it's all volunteer based.
I'm just wondering what the history of WUSC is like. How did it start? How long has it been in existence?
WUSC is I think it started in the 1920s. If you actually go on,
really,
if you Google WUSC, you will find that information. And I don't think it was a different name. It wasn't originally WUSC. It wasn't originally World University Service Canada. But I think basically how it started was during the wars that was going on in Europe. Students in Canada decided that they just wanted to help out fellow students in Europe, and they were just sending things like books or clothing. It was just, you know, regular stuff they were sending, and it was just basically students and faculty helping other students. But then I think over the years, you know, they started to notice this, that there were more global issues that were going on, and I think also by the creation of the UN and this mandate on helping refugees, WUSC has then expanded on what they're able to do. But still, it's on the gist of education as the basis of everything that they do. Goes back to the foundation of educating, and it could be educating on work, on how to work, educating you on, you know, just going to school. And so that was how WUSC started. And so now WUSC basically has expanded in covering different aspects of development, but all that goes back to just education, and it, and mainly, you know, trying to get people who are students to run it. So that's, and so we have different programs such as Students Without Borders, where we take students from Canada and we take them to all different parts of the world where they can work with different communities. And so, but that's how WUSC started. So, and in the University of Regina, WUSC has been operating since the 1970s.
And it started with Jack Bowen, was a man on campus who wanted to help out by bringing refugees over. And eventually a partnership was created with his group, which is University of Regina Group for Refugees, so URGR. They originally started out as bringing refugees over, and then they started working in conjunction with WUSC in the Student Refugee Program, because WUSC already had this agreement with the government and other universities, so it was an easy partnership to create there. So, and that's how the U of R functions.
Awesome. So it's been around for a long time.
Yeah,
I didn't
know. And we're doing
that.
A lot of work in different places like Sri Lanka and Malawi. And like it's Botswana. Actually all over the place. We have so many programs like Bike for AIDS, you know, buying bikes so that people can take people to the doctor because there's no vehicle. So there's actually a lot of programs that go on. And we have international forums and we have different international seminars that we hold in different parts of the world. So it's actually a big program that's in partnership with a lot of bigger programs too, such as Unitera. And I'm sure they're probably partnered with Amnesty International. It's so it's, I think people have run into WUSC without really knowing that was WUSC. So, yeah.
So definitely. Probably the genesis as far as the more modern would dates back to UN starting up, you know, around 1945 or so. Yeah.
With the UNHCR.
Yeah. Awesome. I had no idea.
Yeah.
But I guess not surprising, you know, when you have educators getting together and they can see needs and you know try and figure out what they can do to help things along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
We're getting close to our break time. Anything else you want to touch on before we do that?
I don't think so. I think after the break we'll talk more about the changes in Canada that have happened recently, and maybe that's how that has affected refugee rights and the WUSC program as well. So, yeah, we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay, you're listening to Human Rights Radio. I'm Jim Hutchings with Elena Seiferling, and we have our two guests with us, Aurora Ellig and Patience Umaro Weneza. And we'll be right back.
Ooh, 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 ooh,
that's a band called Dry the River, and they're from Australia, and they were doing an acoustic session there at a Beach Break live festival in South Wales. So there you go. I just thought, I liked it, so that's why we played it.
That is a good reason. It's okay. All right, so today on Human Rights Radio, if you were here for the first half, we're talking to two students here from the University of Regina. We have Aurora Ellick and Patience Umerawaneza, and they're both part of the World University Services of Canada, also known as WUSC for short purposes, which is a organization across the country at different universities. Let's see if I get this right here, girls. And they do a lot of programs for refugee rights around the world, and also one of the things they do is the Student Refugee Program that brings students from around the world to Canada to study here. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Right. Okay, cool. So, we were talking a bit about what the program is and stuff like that, but I know that this year there have been some changes that have affected you from the federal level here in Canada, so I thought maybe we'd talk a little bit more about that. Amnesty International is concerned as well about some of the changes that have been affecting refugee health as well as just refugee law in general. So, yeah, I don't know if you want me to talk about it a bit, or do you have any opening thoughts on federal policy? Okay, well, then I'll talk about it first. So the first thing is just changes in law for refugees in Canada. And, so Amnesty is concerned about a few things. I'm going to try and summarize this the best I can because it gets a little jargony at some points here. This is a new bill that was passed, Bill C-31. And some of the changes, I think, have already taken place, and others will occur probably in December of this year. First of all, there's changes immediately for humanitarian and compassionate assessment applications. And I think I understand that to be if there's a need for an application that's humanitarian or compassionate-based, like a family relation or a medical need, perhaps, like things like this that are kind of more immediate or things like that. And there'll be changes for that, which I think is a negative thing. As well, it says that immigration officers now have powers to arrest and detain foreign nationals and permanent residents on a number of grounds related to suspected criminality, even if the events took place in another country many years ago, which seems really, really ridiculous, I think.
I'd call that bordering on draconian, but anyway, that's just my opinion.
Yes, personal opinion here. It seems that basically somebody can try and come to Canada and just for any little tiny thing, years and years ago, some sort of strange connection that somebody could think is there, they might not be allowed to come here if they need to.
Is there some kind of a mechanism that could be appealed or...?
I think so. I'm trying to remember as well. A few months ago on the program here, we talked about the annual general meeting that Amnesty International Canada held, which was in June in Vancouver. And at that meeting, I went to a session about refugee rights and this law changing. And they were talking specifically about two cases where refugees had come over trying to claim refugee status on boats. And I think one was the MV Sunsea and one was the Ocean Lady, the two ships. And I think one was in 2011, one was 2010, if I remember correctly. And so there were some lawyers that were talking about those cases. And it seems to kind of fit in with this law as well, in that example that they used was the one, I can't remember if it was a woman or a man, but there was some sort of ring or piece of jewelry, and somehow this jewelry was supposed to be part of a gang ritual back in the country they had come from. And so they were like, oh, you have this piece of jewelry, that means you're part of this gang, that means we don't want you here. And that was their reasoning for not allowing them to claim refugee status, but actually the lawyers traced it back to a different, like a family like crest or something that had nothing to do with this like violent gang. And so they were like, well, you have to do your research and figure out, you can't just be like, you have this piece of jewelry, don't come into our country. Because anyway, so yeah, I think it kind of fits in with that, and that it seems to me, and I don't know everything about this issue, but it seems like now officials are kind of able to pull at strings and find these little reasons that people aren't going to be allowed to claim refugee status here in Canada, which I think is too bad, because there's a lot of people that might need that or want that, and we're known internationally as a nice country where people can get help.
To mention we need the workforce.
Right.
Well, that's another reason. It doesn't really make sense.
It just shows it's much it's much preferred to do this kind of legal formality before you come here, mm-hmm. you know, when it's possible. Mm-hmm. I'm sure these other people were quite desperate. Mm-hmm. And they paid a lot of money and probably everything they had, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, that's the other thing. But you heard stories of that, too, where they would pay, I don't know, however many hundreds of dollars it would be Canadian, but all this money to come to get a spot on this ship, and then they might not even make it here because some people would die along the way or get sick or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then they finally get here, and then they're just told that they can't stay. Yeah, and actually, I'm reading as well on this other kind of media release from Amnesty about Bill C-31. It says that the minister, which I guess would be the Minister of Foreign Affairs, perhaps, now has power to designate a group of persons arriving in Canada without proper documents. Once designated, people can be detained for a long time and have no right to appeal a negative decision if they make a refugee claim. So, apparently there's no appeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, this kind of the direction our government seems to be going in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too bad. So, does any of that affect WUSC, do you think? Or do you, because you were mentioning before that it's more at the UN level, you think that because of their kind of overflow of applications for student refugee program and things like that, they're kind of just narrowing down mm-hmm. the eligibility requirements? Or do you think that these kind of law changes affect the programming as well here in Canada?
WUSC is affected in terms that we support refugees in general. And yes, our program makes it so that refugee students are the ones that we're able to bring in, and that also is a small, like, so basically we accept people from, you know, I don't know, I guess 18 to whatever,
26.
To 26, and they have mm-hmm. to be single, and, you know, and so obviously there's a lot of people that are not eligible for this program, but in general we do support all WUSC, all refugees, and our refugee students come, have family members that they would like to come as well. And these family members will probably never be able to come through WUSC and will have to mm-hmm. pass through just the regular channels that refugees come to Canada. And this affects them because this means that now that when they do come, the necessary provisions that they should have, such as just getting health care, is not mm-hmm. there anymore in place. Mm-hmm. And we've had cases on the news where someone, they've had like an eye problem and it was very urgent and they weren't covered for this. And the doctor at that hospital just had to do it anyways. And he said, we'll just figure out the cost later because, you know, so people mm-hmm. are able to be denied these things, including childbirth apparently is mm-hmm. going to be one of right. the things that they can deny. And it's just, and the attitude that's being put forward that refugees receive better health care than regular Canadians is almost ridiculous in saying that this is the reason why we're able to take away health care mm-hmm. because, you know, you're getting better health care than regular Canadians, which is not the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And also we have to remember that Canada, we used our health care as our trademark to differentiate mm-hmm. ourselves from everyone else and say that this is our national symbol almost, you know, mm-hmm. the universal health care. But we know that as it is, it's already being privatized more and more. But now, on top of that, the people that need it the most are being denied of this health care. And it's just, I don't know how that even makes any sense, because to compare the number of refugees that come to the number of Canadians that need health care, it's really very different. And actually, the amount of money that it costs every Canadian to pay for health care for a refugee, I think it's 59 cents or 69 cents. And so when you think about that, you pay that, not even a dollar, so that someone can get your health, so they can get the proper health care. I mean, when you go to another country, you would expect that at least they would take care of you also if you fall ill. And it's just crazy that we're already making a big deal out of that little number. Mm-hmm. But I think people are not even aware of actually how much it costs. They just think that, you know, here are the immigrants taking our jobs, taking our health care. But that's really not the case. And I mean, we have also to go back to who we are as people. We are not just Canadians. We're members of this earth. And our actions not only affects us, but affects everyone. And once we start denying people this, I don't know how this is going to come back to us. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Yeah, that's a very, very good points there. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a disturbing trend in Canadian society, I mm-hmm. have to say. That we're becoming less generous,
yeah.
you know,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and I think a part of it is a lack of awareness of what's actually needed, what's mm-hmm. required, and as you're saying, the actual costs, which
very
are
minimal,
not that much,
yeah.
mm-hmm. And somehow or other, they think it's our present government seems to think it's some kind of a virtue to be withdrawing funding from these programs, and
yeah.
I think there needs there probably needs to be some changes made.
I just don't know how an idea like that even comes up in office. How do you decide, I think we're going to save funding, so we're going to cut the money from refugee health care. I don't know how a person comes up with that and then actually shares that with somebody without feeling like they're going to look a little
draconian,
ignorant, or like some kind of monster. I mean, how do you, what kind of person decides that that's a good idea to take something from our weakest members of society, the ones that need the most help?
And, you know, let's not forget that a lot of times when changes like this need to happen, they always appeal to the economy, and the economy is some kind of religious thing that's going on in our society, and it's like we don't understand what the economy is. It's this God, but we just have to do it because, you know, it's the economy. You know,
it's a really good analogy.
And we don't even look into it. You know, we don't even try to look and see because we won't understand because we're just normal people. So let's leave it to the experts. But the truth is, when you do look at the economy, I mean, I'm sure it can be complicated, but you could look at your individual, what you do as an individual, how it affects your country, and you could see that. In all honesty, these social programs are way better for our economy, are way better for our society than making people, like individual people, pay for these costs. You know, we can share this burden, and in the end, it will make our society better. Like we said, Wolf students that come are very good members of society. They contribute to our society, and we're not aiding them in getting there by cutting down 69 cents per person. You know, and when does this stop? We're saying now that we're not doing this for refugees, but I mean, okay, we'll start with the outsiders, but when is this going to stop for our own Canadian people? And let's not also forget that every Canadian, except for First Nations people, are all immigrants. And at some point, we had to come on a boat, and at some point we had to rely on the generosity of the people that were already here to get us by. And so if they helped us to get by, and if our families have survived, you know, are we just going to keep that to ourselves, or are we going to pass that forward?
Patience, I think that you need to go talk to people in high up positions and say exactly what you just said. Because I think you put that very well. No, I think.
Yeah.
But seriously, I think you make very good points and very well said as well. So I think that's exactly what we need more of.
More people have to hear it, that's for sure. More people have to become aware. And that it's awareness that makes change.
And another thing I wanted to mention as well about refugee health, because that's another thing that Amnesty's been writing about and has been concerned about. I think it's called the Federal Interim Health Program. Is the program that's changing? Yep. So Amnesty's talking about how it's discriminatory. It's going to result in violations of right to health of refugees, as you said, patients.
Yes.
And they're also talking about how it goes against Canada's international human rights obligations, which we've already touched on. And yeah, so in the Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which Canada has ratified in 1976, it says that it recognizes the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And it says you cannot discriminate on things such as the right to health, and discrimination on the basis of national origin is specifically prohibited. So that kind of puts it in another more perspective as well, I think. And also in terms of how it's kind of been showcased in our society, I guess, saying that refugees get better health care than Canadians, so that's why we need to cut it down to the same level.
Where does that come from? I don't understand.
It's the wrong way to look at it, but this past weekend, Dr. Ryan Miley, who's a doctor in Saskatoon, he was at an event that we were at, and he was speaking about kind of these changes that are affecting healthcare in Canada kind of broadly. But one of the topics he talked about was refugee health, and he put it in a way that I really liked. He was talking about how the way that this message is being said, and because things... Okay, so basically, now if a refugee comes to Canada, it's saying that only urgent and essential care is what they'll receive, which I don't even know how you can determine what is urgent and essential, but anyway.
Probably if you're dying, they'll look after you.
And also if they're going to be a risk to the public, like if they have HIV or something like that, then I guess they'll get treatment because you don't want the Canadians to get hurt. But anyway, but it says that, so things like vision care, dental care, and prescription medication will be eliminated completely. And Dr. Miley was talking about how as well, as that, things like psychiatric treatment is going to be gone. And he was talking about how you think like, oh, well, I don't receive that as part of my healthcare plan.
Maybe
so
you should.
Maybe the refugees shouldn't either. Like, people could think of it that way, but exactly, maybe we should. But the point I'm making with this long-winded story is that Dr. Miley was saying that you need to think about not in terms of equality of what you receive, but equality in terms of what you need, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're someone that's just arrived in Canada, perhaps from a violent situation, perhaps there was war, whatever was happening in your family, maybe the thing you need most is psychiatric help. Like, maybe you need, you know, maybe that's mm-hmm. something that becomes urgent and essential. And mm-hmm. every, like, other Canadians might not have that same need. So I think you put that in a really good perspective to sort of talk about how mm-hmm. it's not just a list of things that you do or do not get, but it's also more broadly than that, what you need and what you would really help you to be a better person and to more contribute to society and to, you know, yeah. get your life together and all of these things. So,
well, and psychiatric need is so, it's so important and significant in our society, especially in terms of refugees who come here in some cases without their family. They come here completely mm-hmm. alone.
Mm-hmm.
They could have been political prisoners, child soldiers. How can you deny somebody psychiatric help when they need it? Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there just a shooting in a theater because a man needed psychiatric help?
Mm-hmm.
Should we be denying people these things when they become, you can become a danger to mm-hmm. yourself or society if you don't get the things that you need.
Mm-hmm.
And psychiatric need is so imperative for somebody who comes here from a really violent situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Patience. And I was also going to say on that line, at the same time, it doesn't make sense that we deny a certain group of population healthcare and then mm-hmm. we say this is supposed to make our country better, because we do know that everyone counts in how the country is better. And, you know, population health, they don't just look at, you know, how many people go to the hospital, how many Canadians are in the hospital. This affects everyone. And also, let's not forget that refugees don't just happen out of a vacuum. Our policies, our actions mm-hmm. as countries affect how these problems happen in different countries. And so I'm not saying Canada is the result, is the reason why a lot of things happen in other countries, but there, we all play a role in how different problems have happened in different parts of the world that has created this massive number of refugees that go on in the world. And we know that Canadians who used to come to Canada were also some kind of refugees from their own countries,
mm-hmm.
whether they were coming for economic reasons, they were coming because of the different wars that were happening. You know, we've all had some kind of refugee, you know, situation that has happened in our families. And for us to all be better, back then the government gave us land and all these different provisions to make, you know, life easier here.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't just deny one group of people that and then say that the country will be better.
Mm-hmm.
Most of our Irish descendants are refugees from the Irish potato famine.
So we're all, you know.
And that's just mm-hmm. in this past century. It's,
yeah.
We are all here for the most part. A significant amount of our population are all here because we were refugees or immigrants at one point or another.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
To that's deny important. Our current refugees when we weren't denied those things, it's just, yeah. it's a ludicrous idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's an important thing that maybe people might not think about, or I mean, I haven't really thought about it quite in that context. So yeah, I think it's a really good way to think about it, to kind of remember that, yeah, okay, you were in the same position once, so, you know, it's just in terms of
mm-hmm.
extending that same help to other people. And yeah, I think as well, especially since Canada signed on to the UN Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, so it seems like then we shouldn't have a choice in the matter. We should just be like, okay, we have to do these things that are good for people, and we can't deny health based on country of origin and nationality. We can't deny mental health rights, so it's all there. But apparently, that's not the case, I guess.
And it's interesting. I do a lot of traveling, and in previous years, people have always held Canada in such high regard. When I tell people I'm mm-hmm. from Canada, they mm-hmm. always fist pump and say, yeah, you're from Canada, that's awesome, and then, you know, followed by, are you from Quebec or, you know, Vancouver? But now it's not the same. When I go traveling now, just in the past couple of years, that mm-hmm. attitude has changed, and it's disheartening because I'm very proud of this country,
mm-hmm.
but mm-hmm. people around the world, they're taking notice of how we are changing our policies. It's mm-hmm. not something that just we're internalizing here and only mm-hmm. noticing here. The rest of the world is seeing it, and I think it's time that our citizens start to see it
mm-hmm.
because these policies are not helping our country be better or look better mm-hmm. in the slightest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a good example of what you're talking about is when the last temporary seat came up in the Security Council and they elect members to the Security Council.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we were rejected.
Canada was in the running, and they withdrew because they could see that they were not going to get the votes to take a seat on the Security Council. And this was a first. Mm-hmm. It would be a no-brainer before that Canada would get that seat, but Portugal got it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Portugal's one of the economic crises countries in the European Union, so explain that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So just to avoid the embarrassment of being rejected in an actual election, they chose to withdraw.
Mm-hmm. Instead of make an adequate claim.
It kind of tells you.
Yeah, definitely. So maybe let's just pick this up a little bit here, because we've been talking a lot about the problems that are happening, which obviously we need to work on. But I think we were talking a bit about how we think our society is getting a bit less generous and stuff, but I think that students such as you guys that are working on programs like WISC and you're volunteering your time to make sure this program continues and make sure it's successful and that you can bring students here is an example of how we are not all becoming like that. And there's still hope and we can still work together and make things better. So I think that's great.
You guys have work to do, though, I'll tell you.
Yeah, well,
there are changes that need to be made, and it's the young people that are going to bring this forward.
But, you know, I also wanted to add that we have had generous support from a lot of faculty and staff and different programs on campus that, you know, that are just willing to help. But sometimes also they can't help because of also funding reasons and all these mm-hmm. different things. But there are a lot of staff and faculty out there that are just, they've been helpful in helping the young people really push forward, and they have that knowledge that comes with years or, I don't know, whatever. And so there's definitely, you know, a community of people out there that mm-hmm. are willing to help that want to help. Mm-hmm. But in the same time, there's also people out there who are making it difficult for people to help. So I think we just have to keep in mind of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I think that's a good point as well. And also, that made me think, it's not really related, but I guess sort of, that WISC does still have this agreement with the Canadian government, so you do still have, you know, ties. Even if cuts are being made, at least, you know, you still have your program, and mm-hmm. you can hopefully work within some sort of reduced budget or lobby for your programming to continue at the same level. And since you already have that link, I think that's great in terms of mm-hmm. being able to already have your foot in the door, I guess, a little bit, which is good. So maybe in the last few minutes that we mm-hmm. have here, is there anything else exciting about your new students that arrived? Like, do you know what any of them want to study, or are any of them, like, super excited? How was the arrival yesterday? Like, you know, any exciting things there?
It's interesting because we always have male students coming over. They are used to the mindset that they have to be the breadwinner. So they come mm-hmm. over here and they want to do engineering or business and accounting. They want jobs that are guaranteed their money. So it's really interesting that the girls that we all got last night are all interested in doing stuff in the arts, be it mm-hmm. international affairs. One wants to go into education. So it's just, it's really interesting the difference in that the girls want to do stuff that's going to make a difference. The men come over and want to make money. So it's just, it's an interesting change, but it's also an exciting one for us to have these four new girls that all want to do something and they all want to make a change. And a couple of them have gotten further education in the camp in Thailand. Oh. So they have taught in the camps. So it's one of the good things that we have these girls who are already motivated and want to help. So, mm-hmm. it's exciting that they'll be active members of the club.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that's something common, though, that you're going to find with participants in this program, that they're certainly grateful that they're a part of the program, but they're already looking, they're trying to find ways that they can give back both to the place they've come from and to the people that are giving them help.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. I also wanted to add that community members are also welcomed to help WISC. In fact, you know, there's only students that are helping right now, but having community members definitely makes the group even more stronger. And there's been cases in other provinces where the community has helped, and it has helped the group be able to sponsor even a child, a mother and a child mm-hmm. as well. So if any community members out there want to help, they are welcomed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and on that note... We're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to a discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.